Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair and Panoply. I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, and I'm here with Vanity Fair's film critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And Vanity Fair's digital director, Mike Hogan.
Hey.
We have lost Joanna this week, but we have gained a very special guest in Andrew Garfield, the star of Hacksaw Ridge and Silence, recently nominated for a Golden Globe, who is going to tell us about his experiences on the awards campaign and in making two very different, but I think equally challenging movies with Mel Gibson and Martin Scorsese, and what it's like to have two movies out there to promote at once and how he possibly keeps his head straight and his hair so gorgeous. But first, we're going to talk about the Golden Globes themselves and what we learned from them, as well as a slew of other nominations this week, the BAFTAs, the PGAs. It's a busy time for awards, so we're going to dig into what we've learned from all that. So the Golden Globes were on Sunday night, which now, given everything that's happened in the world, feels like 2 years ago, but it was...
What do you mean? What's happened?
just some news.
There weren't even any... Never mind.
Speaking of golden.
So go back to that time 4 days ago when we watched Moonlight kind of pulled out a win at the very end, maybe when we had all given up hope, and then La La Land really swept the whole thing. They won 7 statues, everything they were nominated for.
Which is the most ever, right?
Ever.
Yeah. I think it might
Which
be.
Which seems weird to me, but. Anyway,
I know, it does, because it didn't have any supporting nominations. It feels like there could be more. But anyway, what do we learn other than that La La Land is kind of poised for a big award season?
Well, we learned who is going to suffer, I guess, at the expense of La La Land.
Which is everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, Manchester and Moonlight both sort of limped away with one award, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Moonlight, you can't say limped because it won Best Drama,
yeah,
which is obviously a huge award. And Manchester won Best Actor, which is a great award, too.
Mm-hmm.
But no screenplay for Kenny Lonergan.
The La La
no...
screenplay win, I think, was big for Manchester. I mean, that's not good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
kind of showed that like the love is really, really real.
Yeah.
And Mahershala Ali losing to Nocturnal Animals was also pretty...
Losing to Aaron Taylor Johnson, who is in Nocturnal Animals.
Aaron Taylor Johnson.
Well, and I feel like this is the useful place to do the caveat where the Golden Globes is voted on by about 90
alleged
journalists. None of whom are in the Academy.
Right.
How seriously do we take things like that Aaron Taylor Johnson win? Like, I think Mahershala Ali is still very much a lock to win the Oscar.
I think Aaron Taylor Johnson does not have to worry about taking extra space on his mantle. He can just put the globe wherever it fits, and that's fine.
Yeah.
You know, I think I liked that movie. Some people didn't. It would be interesting to see what happens with the Academy, but it feels very globesy. It's like
it
there's something about it. I don't know why.
There's sort of a Euro aesthetic to it, you know.
Yes.
And I think the other thing is that Aaron Taylor Johnson, you know, he's a Brit and he's been around in sort of consciousness maybe a little bit longer than Mahershala Ali has been, at least in terms of, like, you know, the level of fame that they're at. So I
yeah.
think it was maybe just a more familiar vote for them.
Sure.
Whereas I think the Oscars have proven themselves over the years to be a little bit better at not going right for the sort of celebrity and maybe more sort of looking down the line to who might be big in the future, I guess.
Right. And yeah. even though the Oscar voting body has a huge number of legacy, you know, older white guys, they have made a bunch of strides in the last 2 years to bring on a lot of diverse voters, which, you know, we don't know who the Hollywood Foreign Press 90 people are, but, you know, I don't know of any effort like that. So,
yeah.
So I think Mahershala Ali, it would be interesting if the Oscars feels obliged to sort of correct the record there.
Right.
I feel like it's a rare case where they might take that approach.
Yeah, I mean, there was a somewhat troubling optics thing with Mahershala Ali losing. Considered the front runner, loses to a white guy. Courtney B. Vance, considered the front runner, loses to a white guy. Sterling K. Brown, considered the front runner, loses to a white guy. That happened three times at the Golden Globes.
Yeah, the People versus OJ winner was the white person, Sarah Paulson, who was amazing and deserved everything.
Yeah.
So what beat the actors from People versus OJ was The Night Manager, which is this glossy Euro kind of very HFPA sort of thing.
Yes.
So I think that, you know, there might be a race angle there, and maybe those things are all intertwined, but I don't think that Aaron Taylor Johnson winning really tell us anything. I mean, I think the SAGs are really what's going to kind of decide.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, glossy and Euro. That is a good description of what HFPA tends to go for.
I think we've really let ourselves kind of take a breath with the whole Oscar So White thing, because there were so many contenders this year with people of color in it. Viola Davis is still definitely going to win an Oscar. As we said, Mahershala Ali probably will as well. But I think this is a reminder that it's not that easy. Like, you can't just have Moonlight in the race and feel like that means that you're going to have a diverse slate of winners. You really have to keep pushing it. And it's like, there's resistance in a way.
Well,
and then you look at the BAFTA nominations, where Barry Jenkins and Denzel Washington both failed to get nominated, and you see that there's a lot of room to work.
Right. I mean, look, I feel like I'm just going to come out and say this with the caveat that I'm a white guy, and I'm sure I see this differently than some other folks, but to me, the issue, it should be about opportunity. And if awards are a way to create opportunity by rewarding films that aren't gigantic blockbusters, then if there's any kind of latent racism in the awards process, that's horrible for getting things made. And over again, you see this. Everybody's shocked now that Hidden Figures made a lot of money. It's like, guys, there's a big audience out there. They like these movies.
Yeah.
You know, like, make more of the movies. So I do think that it's harder for me to kind of say, well, this person needs to actually win the award or else, you know, we haven't made any progress. To me, the good progress is there's a lot more seemingly diverse films in the conversation this year.
Yes.
And, you know, hopefully that will continue. It's kind of like, you know, keeping in mind that systemic racism affects people in all kinds of weird ways, you know, it shouldn't be about who actually wins. It should be, are there enough diverse films in this conversation? I don't think there are yet, but it at least seems to be making progress on that.
Well, I think Meryl Streep's speech made headlines for many reasons, but the part where she went through and kind of listed where everyone was from, where she talked about her being from New Jersey and from Dev Patel being born in Kenya and raised in London, and Ruth Negga being born in Ethiopia and raised in Ireland, and kind of the international flair of everybody. I thought that is something that's a badge of honor that the industry can give itself, even if the awards themselves don't wind up as diverse as maybe they wanted or we wanted.
Okay, so let's talk about Meryl's speech. Because to be perfectly honest, Viola's intro, and I thought that montage was not amazing. The whole thing was making me slightly resent Meryl Streep. I'm like, all right, fine, greatest actress ever.
Right.
And then she just unloaded on Donald Trump, and I was like standing on my couch.
Oh, that's who she was talking about.
Yeah.
Because she never said a name.
That reaction you had is what she does in some of her best speeches, where she's, you know, when she won the Oscar finally, she was like, oh, her again.
Right.
Like,
yeah, exactly.
The beauty of Meryl Streep is she does that before you
can. And her saying her again turned into the title of a book that we excerpted. I mean, like, everything she says in these speeches is gold.
Yeah, she is the master of all this. But, I mean, it's interesting. It touched off a gigantic culture war.
He tweeted about it. You know, as soon as she said, gave the speech, I was like, all
right,
countdown. Yeah.
But I thought it was great. I thought what she said was amazing.
Yeah.
And I thought she kept it relevant to the moment. You know, I don't, she didn't go off on some, you know, random spiel that had nothing to do with the Hollywood Foreign Press Association or movies or awards or artists or whatever. It stayed mostly kind of on message, I think.
Well, and it was, a bunch of people were funny. It was like, somebody said, Meryl Streep is auditioning for the role of my aunt on Facebook. But I mean, but she was kind of everyone's, it wasn't that. I thought it was like mom coming in and being like, well, how are we going to make sense of this insane moment we find ourselves? Yeah. And somebody had to do that, I think, in a way.
Yeah.
And address it, not just in goofy jokes like the ones that Jimmy Fallon did at the beginning, but really put it into context and be like, this is what we stand for, and this is context for why you're hearing us all get hysterical about this moment in history.
I think people who are in that situation are literally given a microphone. You know, the Oscars would be the same thing. Like, you have people watching you. People will listen to what you say. I mean, people follow what actors do all the time. I think you have a responsibility to say something if that's what you believe. And there's kind of, you know, is she preaching to the choir? Like, what are Hollywood actors holding a golden statue supposed to help convince Trump voters? Like, I don't think that's the point. I think it's just kind of having your voice heard for the historical record or for whoever might be able to listen, just to have spoken up when you had the opportunity.
Yeah, not just indulging in an orgy of self-congratulation in a year when that was really inappropriate. And this whole idea of, like, Meghan McCain, like, well, that's why Trump's winning. It's just like, well, too bad. At some point, people have to be able to say what they actually think, regardless of how it impacts Trump voters. That's not really, the election's over now.
Yeah.
you know?
Right. And that's sort of, that's why Trump's winning. It's like, well, what does that even mean? I mean, like,
I think that's a mealy, bullshit.
So everyone should just like either shut up or just kind of agree with, you know, this sort of right thinking. Yeah. The reaction to the Meryl Streep thing was both kind of, it was invigorating in a way to see how angry she made people, but it was also like, oh,
including
God,
the president-elect.
This out of touch celebrity conversation again, especially now when, you know, the president-elect is
an out of touch celebrity.
Completely. You know, so I don't know. I thought it was a good moment in a show that was kind of bumming me out with some, you know, upsets, but also was just kind of like dragging along. That was a real good high point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's the only thing anybody wanted to talk about. I mean, Jimmy Fallon may as well have not been there as the Richard Ewart piece kind of about how he felt. What, not really the right host for the moment, which I think was a good
Well, I think Fallon, you know, look, the show aired on NBC. He's the star of NBC's late. It makes sense in those terms, but to my mind, he's still too tainted by the hair tousling thing with Trump, you know, and then to kind of turn it around and make some Trump jokes during the opening monologue, but also keep it light, keep it fun, keep it La La Land. I just felt like he was not that good at calibrating that balance just because it was a particularly challenging task.
That's a lot. That's, you know, a lot of needles to thread.
Yeah. And it was the first award show post-election, you know, or at least, you know, nationally televised one. So I don't think it's 100% his fault by any means. But, you know, Kimmel now has, you know, it's good that he gets to go second because he can see and try to thread that needle maybe a little bit better.
It's funny what you said in your review I thought was very smart and right, which is, as fun as that La La Land opener was in many ways, it's just a little too soon.
Right.
You know, everyone that I was with was like, wait, what is this? I'm like, oh, this is a La La Land reference.
Yeah. Right. You know? By the time the Oscars are on, people will have had an extra month and a half to see the movie. And it's doing really well. So
it's
people will see it.
It's making some serious money.
But it just felt like, okay, so the screener havers in the room have seen it. The critics watching in the conference room have seen it. But like, you know,
I basically went through that montage explaining every reference to the people in the room.
Right.
That's an interesting problem for the Golden Globes in starting with a montage. You know?
Yeah.
I don't know if they're going to have to
the part of it that made me genuinely laugh was the Barb from Stranger Things emerging from the pool like a Busby Berkeley musical.
That was
like
great.
That was good.
Everyone saw Stranger Things, as far as we know, because Netflix won't tell us how many people actually watched it.
So another big moment was Ryan Gosling.
Yeah.
Who really, I think, put himself back into the hunt a little bit for Best Actor with his very moving speech. Am I crazy?
Well, I mean, people are so interested in his relationship with Eva Mendes because they've been so quiet about it. I mean, really successfully, actually. I think, you know, all credit due to them. Like, we don't know what their daughters look like. They are never photographed together. She didn't go with him. He didn't say her name in the speech, although he did name check her brother who died of cancer. And, you know, Ryan Gosling has developed this mystique about him. Like, the whole hey girl meme was kind of better because he didn't play into it that much. Like, he's not trying that hard for your affection.
Yeah.
And when he gets up there and gives a speech like that and is charming in this like, very tiny bite-sized way, it gives you just enough Gosling that you're like, oh yeah, I like that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause it was a short speech. I think it was like 90 second kind of thing.
Well, I think the challenge for him is similar to the one that Michael Keaton had a couple years ago, which is, this is a slightly standoffish guy. It's unclear, you know, he has mystique, and it's unclear, is that because he's just like a selfish celebrity who thinks everybody's lesser than him, or is it because he's actually a soulful guy who doesn't play the game? And I think in both cases, they had to kind of, with Keaton, it was a lot of stuff about his son. And with Gosling, I feel like it was, I hate to say it, but I'm talking strategy here. You know, he had to convey, like, I have a family. Uh-huh. I care about humans in my life. I'm not just some guy who, like, thinks everyone should kiss my ass. And it was a powerful moment. It really brought a lot of goodwill.
But Keaton lost to Eddie Redmayne, the guy who worked the circuit better than anyone. So there's a limit to how far you can go with that. But then again, Gosling's main competition is Casey Affleck, who comes with his own baggage and awful beard and all the other things that don't make him Eddie
Redmayne. It's funny because in the interview leading up on the red carpet, Casey Affleck was just openly moaning about the fact that he had this beard. And look, because, you know, that's not what you want in your Oscar audition, looking like Grizzly Adams, you know.
Right. Yeah. And I think also he's just a much more recessive presence on stage when he gives speeches. And he was more dynamic, I think, in the room at the New York Film Critics Circle dinner because, well, it wasn't on TV and he had a sort of specific thing that he could needle, you know, the voting body about. But like at the Globes, I mean, he, you know, he said nice things, I guess. But compared to Gosling, who, you know, looked dashing and gave this nice sort of feminist speech, it was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
what about Natalie Portman?
I think I think that, you know,
that should be a Globes
movie. We were going to talk about other like, you know, PJs and stuff. Like, I think Jackie is dropping fast. I think that especially because La La Land is performing so well, box office wise, and it, you know, just won all these awards. And again, the HFPA does not overlap with the Academy, but you know, people in the Academy just saw that movie win a bunch of awards. And I just think that La La Land is so ascendant that Emma Stone is kind of it's there.
Well, you know? And because as we talked about last week, like Jackie does seem to have been boiled down just to Natalie Portman, which yeah. I think is unfair, but that's how it has worked out. Natalie Portman already has an Oscar. There's not this drumbeat being like, oh, well, we have to reward her. It's a great performance. Yeah. I do think she'll be nominated, but I think Emma Stone has this huge narrative push behind her, is super appealing, and in a movie that everybody loves. Like, it's got every yeah. single element. And Jackie, I mean, it's a tough movie to love. I think, you know, a lot of people yeah. haven't embraced it. And I think knowing that she has been rewarded, quote unquote, even though she had this great performance, it's easy to kind of let it fall to the wayside, which is a shame. So the PGA nominations that came out this week after the Golden Globes, which, unlike the Globes, are a window into how the industry is thinking, because it's the Producers Guild Awards, and they are people who are Academy members. And I'm just going to run down the list of everything that got nominated for their main award. It's Arrival, Deadpool, Fences, Hacksaw Ridge, Hell or High Water, Hidden Figures, La La Land, Lion, Manchester by the Sea, and Moonlight.
Yeah. So no Jackie.
No Jackie. No Nocturnal Animals, which I honestly yeah. thought was possible based yeah. on how this week, because it got a lot of BAFTA nominations as well. But yeah, the Hacksaw Ridge, Hell or High Water, and Hidden Figures are kind of the three that I feel like are these ascendants. Yeah. And then there's Deadpool.
I think Hidden Figures, I think that big nomination, I think that means that it's definitely, I think it would end up on the 9 or 10.
Yeah, I think it would. Yeah, I think it's got a Best Picture nomination.
Well, Hacksaw Ridge is basically a...
it's like top...
It's top four.
Yeah.
I think it's basically La La Land, Moonlight, and Manchester and Hacksaw Ridge have been nominated for everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really like seeing Arrival coming in there. I've been feeling good about that.
I think that's also good for Amy Adams, you know?
Yeah, I mean, Best Actress, we were talking about Isabelle Huppert winning the Golden Globe. Again, not the voting bodies overlap, but I think Isabelle Huppert is getting an Oscar nomination.
Yes.
Yeah, and I loved how surprised she was.
Yeah.
She's done that at every time. And I mean,
so fun.
I don't blame her for being surprised. Yeah. Everyone's been counting her out, and then she just keeps winning.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think she definitely has a good shot at that nomination. Yeah, Lion. It's great to see Lion in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Hell or High Water, I get it. And I get Deadpool because it's, you know, it's an unusual superhero movie.
And
that
the
made
PGA
money.
Being producers, they like going for blockbusters. They are much more likely to nominate, you know, they don't nominate The Dark Knight. They go for stuff that's popular more than
other because games. They also understand the logistics. I think also Deadpool had this kind of tortured birth, essentially. I mean, it took a long time for that movie to get made, and it fell out of funding and then into, you know, so I think that there was a feat of producing there, certainly, that I'm sure the people in PGA are like, oh yeah, that got made and then did so well.
And it's not my cup of tea, but at least it's a different take on superhero movie, which is hard to do.
I mean, I would have loved it if it had come out in 1998 and I was a teenager, and you know, it would have spoken to me then.
Yeah,
it's a fascinating time for passion projects. I mean, at the Globes, everyone talking about La La Land was like, this movie was such a gamble, we wanted to make it, which, you know, I don't know that it was that big of a gamble, but sure, that's
their
narrative.
They're sort of grafting an underdog thing onto that.
Sure.
Well, okay, but I think, I mean, unless it's a lie, I think the whole idea that Damien Chazelle basically was like, I want to make this movie, but it's too big.
Oh,
I got to turn around and go make Whiplash first. You know.
But, you know, by the time they made La La Land, it had two giant movie stars in it. You know, it had some pedigree behind it. But then you also have Deadpool, which we were talking about, and Moonlight, the movie that I don't think anyone expected to be a big awards contender. There's some interesting, this into existence.
Not to come back to this, but Moonlight is a movie that I saw thinking, wow, it would be so great if this ended up as the 9 slot at the Oscars. Mm-hmm. And now people are like, I can't believe Moonlight, you know, almost didn't win Best Picture. You're just like, well, this is good. Moonlight is in a great place. If you're Barry Jenkins, you're loving life
Well, this happens every year, I think. There's the movie that you're like, oh, this, you know, Spotlight last year. I mean, I made a bet that Spotlight would not win Best Picture because, like, it's too small, it's too arty, or too, you know, intellectual, and then it went.
Actually, 3 years in a row with Boyhood coming in second and being that movie for me, too. Let this be my, like, slide in there.
I think that we can maybe tribute the 10-wide Best Picture field for that, because you've got the sense that it's more of an open race, and there's a reason for studios like A24 to really put money behind something like Moonlight, thinking maybe it'll get a nomination, and then it just build speed until it's in the top three.
Yeah, and then these little tiny miracle films that do rise to the top have to be so good to have risen to the top that then they stand up pretty well against some of the bigger budget things. That would be an argument that I'd make.
Yeah. I was a little bit nervous about Moonlight after the Globes just because it didn't win one of its expected awards, you know, in the supporting actor, but then was reminded that at the Oscars, its screenplay isn't adapted, so it won't be up against Manchester. So Moonlight actually has a pretty solid chance of winning that Oscar, possibly Mahershala, and then is in the mix for Best Picture. I don't think it's going to win, but, you know, so if it comes away with two Oscars, you know, this time, that would be great, you know? And this happens every year, but after the Golden Globes on Monday, someone wrote, you don't have to watch award shows, they're stupid, and they're, you know, I don't like that argument because I think it's been made a billion times. But look, in the case of something like Moonlight, yes, in New York City, in the media, a lot of people have seen that movie. But people watching the Golden Globes who don't really pay that much attention to movies might not have known that that movie existed. And so for that alone, I'm glad that the Golden Globes happened and that Moonlight won and that, you know, now people know about it.
Exactly. So keeping all of this in perspective, the good thing about award season, there's a lot of dumb, stupid stuff that's horrible that we talk about. But the good thing is that it's elevating art and interesting projects that aren't, you know, the eighth sequel to Fast and Furious, much as I look forward to you.
I mean, to echo Meryl Streep, I would argue that there's more value to the Golden Globes than there is to the Super Bowl, for example, in terms
where
of
there will
culture
be an ad
and
for
humanity.
Fast and Furious.
I really want her to accept that guy's invitation and go to the mixed martial arts thing and make a documentary about her or a reality show.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
And now our conversation with Andrew Garfield, the star of Hacksaw Ridge and Silence. So we're here with Andrew Garfield, who has joined us with his breakfast and is very kind to join us here in studio, which is very exciting. Thank you so much for being here.
No. Thank you. It's my pleasure to be under the inquisition of three very brilliant people.
We try not to make it too much like a panel where we're throwing questions at you. But,
like a trial, really.
Yeah. Well, given the two movies that you're in, we think you're pretty tough and can handle whatever we're throwing at you.
I fooled you, I see.
Well, you've been really busy this week. You know, we saw you on the Golden Globes on Sunday, and then we saw you on Stephen Colbert last night as we record this, so you're kind of all over the place. The Globes were, you kind of had a big viral moment sitting next to Ryan Reynolds, which I know you talked to Stephen Colbert about last night, but were you guys friends? You know Ryan Reynolds already?
No, we had just met. I sat down next to him and we just kind of started talking, and very, very quickly I said to him, we should kiss if you win. And and he said, yes, I think we should.
But then he didn't win.
And he didn't win, and I said, we can still kiss. And he said, let's do it. And, you know, I think it's like, and also makes you kind of think, well, why is the kissing only reserved for the winning moment? Why can't it be, you're enough, whatever happens? I kind of like that idea more.
It satisfied a lot of the Spider-Man Deadpool fanfic I've been writing over the years. So
it was big, just for you.
It was a big thank you.
It was mostly for you and those like you.
And there are many, I promise.
Andrew, one of our audience's favorite moments was when you kind of leapt out of your chair to give an ovation to Emma Stone. Has it been emotional for you guys doing award season together so far? How has that been?
You know, it's been wonderful because we care about each other so much, and that's a given. That's kind of this unconditional thing. And there's so much love between us and so much respect. I'll speak for myself, you know. I'm her biggest fan as an artist, you know?
Yeah.
I'm constantly inspired by her work, and I'm constantly inspired by how she handles and holds herself. So for me, it's been bliss to be able to, you know, watch her success and watch her bloom into the actress that she is. It's also been wonderful to have that kind of support for each other. Nothing but a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Because award season can be sort of a huge pain in the ass.
It's a weird thing. I mean, not my words, but here's the thing. I felt it on Sunday, and I said it to all my friends who were there. I said, you know, I was overwhelmed that I had such sincere, authentic Hollywood friends.
Yeah.
Or friends within Hollywood, which I don't think is a common occurrence. I had about 7 or 8 real true anchors in that room, and then in the parties following. Emma, of course, is one. Claire Foy is another. Laura Dern, Eddie Redmayne, Jonah Hill. These are people that I actually love in a very sincere way, and yeah. and I believe they love me back. And I just was kind of struck with this deep gratitude, you know, including Mel and Vince, and you know, I don't know. It's I was just very, very grateful that I got to be there and celebrating the work of people that I love and just being present. Really, it was really, really lovely. Weirdly. Very strange to have such a lovely time.
Well, you know, even with all those cameras in your face.
Right, yeah. No, I am.
Well, you know, and Mel, this is an interesting moment for Mel Gibson, right? Because it's kind of, there's a form of redemption happening here given his controversial past. How's it been watching him, you know, navigate all this?
I'm so happy for him. Yeah. And I'm so grateful that finally, you know, slowly the external response to him is catching up with the work that he's done internally.
Yeah,
that's how I perceive it. Yeah. He's had a number of years now where he's done that work, done that very difficult internal transformative work, and looked to himself and made some changes. And that's no mean feat as for anyone else who's done that kind of work and been through that kind of transformational process. And I'm just grateful that finally it feels like there's an understanding that work has been done, that there's a feeling that, oh, this is a man that is much more than just those very, very brief moments that we know him for. He's so much more than that.
Yeah.
And of course, simultaneously, he's one of the great storytellers in film. And you can't deny that. I really feel like, especially with audiences, and he taps into this core humanity and universal truths, and makes, I believe, very a nourishing meal for the masses, which is a very, very tricky thing to do in every single film he makes. So I'm very, very grateful that he was the one that was helming our project.
Yeah, we spoke on the phone, you and I, once about 99 Homes. And I think you were in Australia filming Hacksaw. So I guess that would have been about a year ago or so. So how has it been sort of, I mean, managing the experience of these two very intense movies now that are sort of arriving at the same time? Is it, are you just sort of living in sort of like the Desmond Doss emotion, or the sort of 17th century monk emotion all the time? Or does it feel pretty distant to you?
It doesn't feel distant to me, thankfully. I feel, you know, luckily both films deal in similar themes, and even though the journeys are very different, there's a similarity in how I can talk about these two films. And even more luckily, I'm so deeply passionate about these two stories and about Desmond Doss as a human being, everything that he was and everything that he symbolizes and personifies, especially for the times we're in. The human qualities of humility, compassion, living a life of love and devotion and service to your fellow man. These are the things that I hope our president-elect wakes up to within himself at some point. That maybe
don't hold your breath. I'm joking.
Well, we gotta hope, right? We gotta hope.
This is a very pro-Trump podcast. We probably should have told your publicist that
you've walked into the fire now. No,
in terms of Rodriguez's journey, you know, it's for me one of the big features of what Father Rodriguez goes through in silence is that he has to abandon his ego. He has to let his ego be pulverized and decimated in order to truly serve something greater. And again, you know, for the times we're in, for these incredibly narcissistic, egocentric times we're in, not just within our personal lives, but the culture that encourages us to live according to these very egocentric values. I mean, look who we elected. Look at the guy that we just elected. It's I don't need to, you know, we all agree, it's a terrible shame.
But do you find that in something like in Hollywood, in award season, what kind of defenses do you have against that culture? Because a lot of people would say that's Hollywood's culture,
sure,
too, that almost Hollywood invented it.
Hey, I mean, I'm not going to argue that. I actually, the water was poisoned long ago, you know. The value system that's been propagated is absolutely being propagated by the Hollywood system itself. You know, you talk about those parties, you know, you talk about the parties after the Golden Globes or after the Oscars, and it's palpable, that value system. You can taste it.
Yeah.
And depending on where you are in the hierarchical scale on that very night, Mike Nichols said something so wonderful to me when we were talking, when we were doing Death of a Salesman. We were talking about living in Los Angeles, living in New York, and he said, why would I want to live in a city where I can tell what my stock is according to how the valet parking attendant is looking at me on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, right.
It's that is a very sick kind of lost soul searching, but looking for love in all the wrong places kind of culture. And absolutely, I it's a struggle, I'm not going to lie. I mean, just to move in those rooms, you know, we talk about, you know, the collective unconscious, the collective unconscious of that city of Los Angeles is very, very specific. And you can taste it. And it's very, very dangerous for the artist, I believe.
So how do you, I mean, how did you avoid that? I mean, yourself, like, do you think it was meeting the right people when you were starting out or being a certain age when you started or being English? I feel like English actors tend to be better at avoiding all of that.
We're very good at being very hard on ourselves and not accepting any praise whatsoever.
Pretty much.
And deflating our any buildup that may happen at any point. That's why it was nice hanging out with Eddie, because we just kind of like beat up on each other and ourselves all the time. So that's lovely, and vital. And again, I go back to Mike, you know, Mike Nichols always said to me, he was like, you're going to be all right because you're always going to loathe yourself.
And he's not even English.
I say that to Richard all the time. Yeah, that's true.
But there's something very, very healthy. And I think that there's a balancing act that needs to happen. Yeah, I think it is about who you surround yourself with. And I think, but I mean, I'm not exempt. I struggle with my own version of temptation and seduction into the value system that is so prevalent and so present that you can't escape it. It's a weird thing. It's like, you know, in Bhutan, they write like prayers on the walls for the, you know, healing of the world. And in Los Angeles, we put teenagers in their underwear on the walls. It's a very weird kind of culture that we've created and that we're participating in. And so I'm constantly asking, how do I be in it but not of it? Mm-hmm. And is that a possibility? Do you get corrupted anyway? Is that just going to happen? But again, you know, I hang out with people like Laura Dern, who has somehow managed to hold on to her divine soul amidst, you know, her parents, of course, came from the generation previous of Hollywood actors, and I'm surrounded by mentors like that, and
she's,
I think that's
a
vital
thing.
She's
a big TM person, isn't she?
She is. Yeah, she's a meditator. I meditate. Yeah, I do TM and other forms, and yeah, I'm always trying to look for love in the right places. But yeah, no, I need something. I'm about to start Angels in America in London, doing a play, and I was saying to my friend yesterday, I said, I need a guru to get through this. I don't know how the hell I'm going to do this. I need like some support system in order to climb that mountain every night. And
Ryan Reynolds
is going to relocate and shoot Deadpool 2.
I wanted to ask you about Angels in America because, you know, you're playing Pryor, correct?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That to me, you know, when I was studying theater in college, that play and that role specifically are just to me, you know, this mountain. What about that specifically appealed to you? Was it a text that you knew well? How did you approach it?
So Tony Kushner, I got to know while I was doing Salesman here in New York with Mike. And of course, I'd seen Mike's HBO series. I'd never seen it live, but I had obviously read the play and knew the play. And I hold it up there with anything that Miller wrote and anything that Tennessee Williams wrote. I know a lot of people feel the same way. And I had the same feeling when Tony emailed me. And he said, he wrote the most eloquent, kind of beautiful email, basically giving me no choice but to say yes. But it was very, very easy to say yes. It was one of those things that was just pure instinct. And for whatever reason, it was one of those roles that I actually never considered playing, weirdly. Mm-hmm. But as soon as the idea presented itself, I don't know, the deepest part of me just said, there's no question. No matter when they want to do it, no matter how long the run is, you must. It was just an opportunity too good to pass up. And then, of course, the fact that Marianne Elliott is directing it, and then this incredible cast has been filled by these, you know, Denise Goff and Nathan Lane and Russell Tovey and these great English actors, Nathaniel. I don't know. It's kind of a dream. I wish I had a bit more time to process it. So I don't really know why I want to do it so desperately.
Maybe you'll find out as you're doing it.
I hope so. There's one line which I'll kind of mention, which is I'm 30 years old and I haven't done anything with my life yet. I think I'm paraphrasing it and fucking it up a little bit, but there was something in that that made me, I don't know, that hooked me. I don't know.
And are you doing, is it Millennium Approaches and Perestroika, or just Millennium Approaches for now?
No, we're crazy enough to attempt
both.
You're
going to do both. The whole damn thing. Well, I'm hoping to see it.
Please. I'd love that.
I'm excited.
There's kind of a, when you do a long play like that, or either the movie Silence or Hacksaw Ridge, there's like a physical challenge element where you kind of, you're not just like acting in a movie or acting on a stage. You're really physically preparing yourself. Is that challenge aspect of it something that attracts you to something? You know, you can't just show up on set for 5 days and walk away. You have to, you know, lose weight for Silence, or you know, go through huge battle scenes for Hacksaw Ridge. Like, is there a masochism there, or just like the challenge of it?
I don't know about a masochism. I mean, maybe. I wouldn't put a negative bent on it myself, but if masochism can be positive, then yes.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, there's something I like about being totally consumed by something. I don't know, maybe it's, I don't know, there's something that, I don't know, that attracts me to things that aren't easy and that will take all of my being, and even with all of my being involved, I'm not going to achieve it. There's something that is delightfully agonizing about that for me. I don't know what it is. It's that thing of life being very short and wanting to reach further than my arm's length enables me to. I can't explain it. I don't know if I can go back into my family upbringing and dig up some trauma that explains why, but I don't know. I think there's a longing. There's just a deep longing to know everything and to experience everything. And I get to do that with acting, and my adrenals are shot. That's the main price.
I always worry about people who lose a bunch of weight for a role. Like, you know, what it will do when you're 40 and like suddenly your weight is not under control.
It seems like
it's got to be really hard on you.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, time will tell. I'll let you know in 7 years.
How did you get Mel Gibson to let you keep all your hair? Because I feel like that's one of the great things is, you know, there's no crew cut. And I wouldn't have cut the hair either. But did you have to cut a deal or something? Or how did you
that's
do
funny.
That?
No, well, that was the style in the 40s, you know. Actually,
oh, okay.
If you look at pictures.
So I'm ignorant then.
Well, no,
I
wasn't.
Crew cuts.
Yeah, no, it wasn't crew cuts. It was the guys had their hair reasonably long on top, and then they had it short back and sides. Mm-hmm. That was the style in the 40s. And Desmond especially, he was kind of, obviously, kind of unique and eccentric.
Right.
And his hair was especially kind of interesting. So there was that to play with, I guess.
And how many days did you spend shooting those battle scenes? I mean, that was it as grueling as it looks on screen? Or
it was really grueling, but Mel had no time. That was the crazy thing.
Yeah.
He made a $40 million movie look like an $80 million movie, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really grueling, but you kind of go, well, I would jokingly kind of text Vince at the end of certain nights going, fake war is hard. but you know, it's like, fuck off. Like, right. These are people have lived through this and
less hard than Iwo Jima
and died in this kind of horror. And so it was our responsibility to depict it and to live through it as much as humanly possible. And again, it's another one of those not enough things. We're never, ever going to fully honor what the men and women who serve go through, and any complaint that those scenes are too graphic or pornographic in terms of their fetishizing of violence, I'm willing to have a conversation about that. But from my perspective, it was a vital thing to make it as gruesome and as horrific as possible, in order to honor the reality that these men and women who serve go through, and of course to honor the fact that Desmond, amidst such hell and carnage, walked out with the purest of hearts, somehow survived, and saved 75 men's lives in the process. The miracle of what he did would not have been as profoundly felt by an audience if we didn't express the truth that was going on around him. And we had to leave stuff out. There was stuff that Desmond did within that battle. Like, after he got his leg got blown up with a mortar, he was being carried on a stretcher. He saw another guy in agony, rolled off the stretcher, crawled over to the guy, started patching him up, sent him away on the stretcher that he was just on, and started crawling all the way back towards the ridge and got shot up again in his shoulder. It's like it's like Monty Python at that point.
It becomes unrealistic.
Insane. Yeah, wow. Insane. So
yeah, when I saw the film, I I was like, oh, you know, they ginned a lot of this up for Hollywood stuff. And then I like went to, you know, and read about it. And I was like, oh no, this was like completely
insane.
Exactly what this guy did. I mean, it's wild. You know, so he's guided by a big religious conviction. And, you know, Mel Gibson is a Catholic guy and Martin Scorsese is a Catholic guy and you're playing a Catholic monk. And is that specific kind of religion something that you tap into in your life, or is it more just sort of a metaphor for a different kind of conviction or drive that you have in your own life?
That's a good question. I don't follow a specific doctrine or ideology, but I fell in love with what it was to be a Jesuit for sure. Through this, I've spoken about it in other interviews. He's probably getting sick of being talked about. Father James Martin, who's one of the editors of America Magazine, which is one of the big Catholic magazines, and he's a Jesuit priest himself here in New York City. And just a beauty of a man. And after spending time with him, I'm just like, everyone needs a good priest in their lives. You know, he became my spiritual director and introduced me to all things Jesuit. And introduced me to Thomas Merton, who was a Trappist monk and would write about, you know, Christianity and Eastern religion and how they meet. And, of course, that's what Marty's dealing with in Silence as well. And I'm fascinated by the origins and the etymology, I suppose, of each, you know, the beginnings of each religion and what even predates those things, which are folk stories and folk tales and the indigenous tribes that, you know, you can find the Christ story in indigenous people's stories from the beginning of humanity. So I'm fascinated in that. And it always comes back to story. It always comes back to story making meaning to create context for the chaos and the potential meaninglessness of life. But there's something beautiful about the attempt to frame a life in any type of cosmology, any type of ideology. So I'm absolutely fascinated by it. And for me, my first, I guess in retrospect, I didn't know it at the time, but my first spiritual experience was watching a film. That really was it. Was watching a story play out that I could project myself into, be reflected by, and feel closer to myself and all those around me.
A specific film?
Goodness gracious. Well,
Deadpool.
Deadpool, yeah. That's the first film I ever saw. You know, the film that comes to mind, which was maybe one of the first, was It's a Wonderful Life,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, if any film talks about what in life is meaningful, it's that film. So.
Mm-hmm.
And then theater. Then when I saw my first play, I think that's when the walls really fell down in my mind. I suddenly understood that storytelling was not just something that was in this little screen, but actually it was done by flesh and blood people, and there was something accessible about it then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You've been really busy, but has there been a movie from 2016 that's now, you know, we're talking about these awards things that really grabbed you?
Mm-hmm.
Any movie in particular other than your own?
Oh, no.
no. In that case, absolutely.
Oh, other than my own. What did I see? I've seen a lot of really wonderful things. Goodness, I don't know which ones to talk about though, because I don't want to play favorites in any way. You know what I'm gonna cite? Popstar, Never Stop, Never Stopping.
Great choice.
Yeah. I think that may be my favorite film of the year.
All right.
And an underappreciated one at that.
Yeah.
It's a genius, you know, it's Spinal Tap for the Justin Bieber age. It's and the songs are genuinely good. Like, you can actually listen to them and enjoy them and not just laugh. And I think those guys are just absolutely brilliant. So, yeah, there's my vote.
Do you know them at all? Okay, so can we hope for, like, a collaboration in the future?
If they asked, I'd be there, yeah, absolutely.
Do you rap? Are you ready for that?
Only in private so far, but we'll see. Only when I'm... No, I'm not going to go into that.
Can you see your own movies and experience them on any narrative level? Or are you just totally stuck in, oh, that day on set was hot, or I had that lunch or something like that?
It's funny. It's a sign of a tremendous filmmaker if they can make me forget that I'm present. And I am happy to say that with both Hacksaw Ridge and Silence, I forgot that I was in the films. Not because I was transported by my own performance in any way, shape, or form. It's just that the storytelling was so profound, I found, and so visceral, and I couldn't pay attention to all of the things that I missed, to all of the mistakes that I made. I couldn't indulge in any of the self-loathing that Mike Nichols accused me of. And that's it's only a testament to those two master filmmakers, Martin Scorsese and Mel Gibson.
It's hard to believe it's been 7 years since The Social Network.
Mm.
And that was... Probably is that your first time around the awards circuit?
Mm-hmm.
So what's different this time?
I know myself better. Mm-hmm. Oh, God, what a horrible thing to say.
Well, you're older. I mean, that comes with age.
Yeah, it's a simple matter of time with myself. No grand gesture here, just time getting used to my ridiculousness. So I think I can stay in my body more.
Yeah.
And I cannot take it seriously or personally, whether things go my way or not. Yeah, I guess I can enjoy it more. And I feel, you know, what's nice is with The Social Network, with these films that we're talking about today, I feel, I don't know, there's a weird thing where you, I think we all in our lives want to feel like what we put into the world represents who we are in the most authentic way possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I can safely say that with that movie, with that Social Network movie, and with these two films, I feel like I've been given an opportunity to express my soul, express part of what I know to be my deepest truth and my deepest self. And that opportunity was afforded to me because of these wonderful filmmakers and because of this wonderful writing and the opportunity to tell these kinds of stories. And I'm going to get to go and do it with Pryor. I'm going to get to find my inner drag queen and express what that is. So I feel very, very lucky. And I think I can be in those rooms. I can be in those awards show rooms if I feel like the work is representative of me. And if not, it's stay at home time.
Right.
Fair enough.
Andrew Garfield, thank you so much for being here with us. I hope that after award season, you get some meditation or vacation or something to get you out of the hubbub.
And go do something with Lonely Island, you know, because you've done a lot of heavy stuff. So yeah. It's time for post Angels in America.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate you having me. Thank you.
Thank you. That does it for this week's Little Gold Men. Thank you so much for listening. And please rate us on iTunes. Hopefully you enjoyed our Andrew Garfield conversation as much as we did and want to share the news with people. You can find us all at vanityfair.com writing about award season and lots of other things. We're all on Twitter at Little Gold Men and on our own. I'm at Katie Rich. Richard?
Rylaws.
And Mike?
Mike_Hogan.
This episode was edited and produced by Alana Milner, and thanks to Lara Mayer and Andy Bowers at Panoply. And this week's award for the advice we never expected from a Hollywood insider goes to Andrew Garfield.
Everyone needs a good priest in their lives.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.